I understand that, she says, and I find it very difficult to believe. Do you know what the evidence is against Jacob at this point? Helen asks. No. So you're basing your assumption of his guilt or innocence on what you know of Jacob, and not on the evidence. Dr. Morano raises a brow. And you're basing your assumption on the evidence without ever having met Jacob. Oh, snap, I think, grinning. Nothing further, Helen murmurs. Judge Cuttings watches Dr. Morano step off the witness stand. Does the prosecution have any witnesses? Your Honor, we would like a continuance, given the short notice we've had. If you want to make a motion to review, Miss Sharp, that's fine, provided we get that far, the judge says. I'll hear arguments now, counselors. I stand up. Judge, we want that competency hearing, and you can review the bail again after it's completed. But at this point, I have a young man who's deteriorating psychologically by the minute. I ask you to put limitations on him, on his mom, on his psychiatrist, even on me. You want him to come in here every day and check in with you? Great, I'll bring him. Jacob Hunt has a constitutional right to bail, but he also has human rights, Your Honor. If he's kept in jail much longer, I think it's going to destroy him. I'm begging you to set bail in a reasonable amount and release my client until after the competency hearing. Helen looks at me and rolls her eyes. Judge, Jacob Hunt has been charged with the first-degree murder of a young woman he knew and supposedly liked. She was his teacher, they spent leisure time together, and the facts surrounding this crime, without getting into details, include incriminating statements the defendant made to the police and strong forensic evidence linking him to the crime scene. We believe this is a very, very strong case for the state. If the defendant is doing this poorly even before his bail hearing, Judge, you can imagine how much incentive he'll have to flee the jurisdiction if you let him out now. The victim's parents are already devastated by the loss of their daughter, and they're terrified that this young man, who's been exhibiting violent behavior inside a jail cell and who doesn't know right from wrong, might be released. We ask that no bail be considered until after the competency hearing. The judge looks into the gallery at Emma. Miss Hunt, he says, do you have any other children?
Yes, Your Honor. I have a 15-year-old son.
I assume he requires attention, not to mention food and carpooling.
Yes.
You do understand that if the defendant were released into your custody, you'd have to be responsible for him 24 hours a day, and that this could significantly affect your own freedom of movement, as well as your responsibilities to your younger son?
I will do anything I have to in order to get Jacob home, Emma says.
Judge Cuttings takes off his reading glasses. Mr. Bond, I'm going to release your client on certain conditions. First, his mother will have to post the family home as surety on bail. Second, I'm going to require that the defendant be on home electronic monitoring, that he not attend school, that he stay in the house at all times, and that either his mother or another adult over the age of 25 be with him at all times. He is not allowed to leave the state. He'll have to sign a waiver of extradition, and he is required to see Dr. Morano and follow all her directives, including taking medication. Finally, he will comply with the competency evaluation when it is scheduled, and you will get in touch with the prosecutor to determine when and where that might take place. The prosecution does not need to file a motion. I'm going to set this case down for review on the day the competency evaluation comes back. Helen packs herself up. Enjoy your reprieve, she tells me. This one's a slam dunk from my side. Only because you're a giant, I mutter.
I beg your pardon.
I said you haven't met my client. She narrows her eyes and stalks out of the courtroom. Behind me, Emma is locked in an embrace with Moon Morano. She looks up at me.
Thank you so much, she says,
her voice breaking like waves over the syllables. I shrug as if I do this all the time. In reality, I've sweated through my dress shirt.
Anytime, I reply.
I lead Emma to the clerk's office to fill out paperwork and pick up the sheets that Jacob has to sign.
I'll meet you in the lobby, I say.
Although Jacob was not in court, he had to be here while we deliberated on his behalf, and now
He needs to sign the conditions of his release and the waiver of extradition. I haven't seen him yet. In all honesty, I'm a little scared to do so. The testimony from his mother and from Moon Murano made him out to be a vegetable. When I approach the holding cell, he's lying on the floor, knees curled to his chest. On his head, he's sporting a bandage. The skin around his eyes is black and blue, and his hair is matted. Christ, if I'd had him in the courtroom, he would have gotten out of jail in 10 seconds flat. Jacob, I say quietly. Jacob, it's me, Oliver, your lawyer. He doesn't move. His eyes are wide open, but they don't flicker as I come closer. I motion for the deputy to open the door of the cell and squat down beside him. I have some papers I need you to sign, I tell him. He whispers something, and I lean in. One? I repeat. Actually, it's several. But hey, you don't have to go back to jail, buddy. That's the good news. For now, anyway. Jacob wheezes. It sounds like 1, 2, 3, 5. You're counting? You're down for the count? I stare at him. This is like playing charades with someone who has no arms and no legs. 8, Jacob says, loud and clear. He's hungry, or was hungry? Jacob, my voice is firmer. Come on already. I start to reach for him, but see his whole body tense an inch before my hand makes contact. So I back off. I sit down on the floor beside him. 1, I say. His eyelids blink once. 2. He blinks 3 times. That's when I realize that we're having a conversation. We're just not using words. 1, 1, 2, 3. Why 5 and not 4? I take my pen out of my pocket and write the numbers on my hand until I see the pattern. It's not 8, it's 8. 11, I say, staring at Jacob. 19. He rolls over. Sign these, I say, and I will take you to your mother. I push the papers toward him on the floor. I roll the pen in his direction. At first, Jacob doesn't move. And then, very slowly, he does.
Jacob. Once, Theo asked me if there was an antidote for Asperger's, would I take it? I told him no. I'm not sure how much of me is wrapped up in the part that's Asperger's. What if I lost some of my intelligence, for example, or my sarcasm? What if I could be afraid of ghosts on Halloween instead of the color of the pumpkins? The problem is that I don't remember who I was without Asperger's, so who knows what would remain. I liken it to a peanut butter and jelly sandwich that you peel apart. You can't really get rid of the peanut butter without taking some of the jelly as well, can you? I can see my mother. It's like the sun when you're underwater and brave enough to open your eyes. She's unfocused and slightly runny and too bright to see clearly. I'm that far below the surface. I have a sore throat from screaming so loud. I have bruises that reach to the bone. The few times I fell asleep, I woke up crying. All I wanted was someone who understood what I had done and why. Someone who gave a damn as much as I did. When they gave me that injection at the jail, I dreamed that my heart had been cut out of my chest. The doctors and the correctional officers passed it around in a game of hot potato, and then tried to sew it back into place. But it only made me look like the Frankenstein monster. See? They all exclaimed. You can't even tell. And since that was a lie, I could trust nothing they said anymore. I would not take the jelly without the peanut butter, but sometimes I wonder why I couldn't have been lunch meat, which everyone prefers. There used to be a theory that autistic brains didn't work right because of the gaps between the neurons, the lack of connectivity. Now, there's a new theory that autistic brains work too well, that there's so much going on in my head at once, I have to work overtime to filter it out. And sometimes the ordinary world becomes the baby tossed out with the bathwater. Oliver, who says he is my lawyer, spoke to me in the language of nature. That's all I've ever wanted. To be as organic as the whorl of seeds in a sunflower or the spiral of a shell. When you have to try so hard to be normal, that means you're not. My mother walks forward. She's crying, but there's a smile on her face. For God's sake, is it any wonder I can't ever understand what you people are feeling? Usually, when I go where I go, it's a room with no doors and no windows. But in jail, that was the world, and so I had to go somewhere else. It was a metal capsule, sunk to the bottom of the sea. If anyone tried to come for me with a knife or a chisel or a crust of hope, the ocean would sense the change and the metal would implode. The problem was the same rules applied to me trying to get out. My mother is 5 steps away. 4, 3. When I was very small, I watched a Christian television program on a Sunday morning geared to kids. It was about a special needs boy playing hide-and-seek with some other children in a junkyard. The other kids forgot about him, and a day later, the police found him suffocated in an old refrigerator. I didn't get a religious message out of that, like the Golden Rule or eternal salvation. I got, "Do not hide in old refrigerators." This time, when I went where I went, I thought I'd gone too far. There was no more pain, and nothing mattered, sure, but no one would find me, and they'd eventually stop looking. Now, though, my head is starting to hurt again, and my shoulders ache. I can smell my mother, vanilla and freesia, and the shampoo she uses that comes in a green bottle. I can feel the heat of her, like asphalt in the summer, the minute before she wraps her arms around me. "Jacob," she says. My name rises on the roller coaster of a sob. My knees give with relief, with the knowledge that I have not faded away after all. Case 6. Bite Me. You probably know who Ted Bundy is, a notorious serial killer who was linked to the murder of 36 victims, although many experts believe that number is closer to 100. He would approach a woman in a public place, gain trust by feigning injury or impersonating an authority figure, and then abduct her. Once the victim was in his car, he'd hit her in the skull with a crowbar. He strangled all but one of his victims. Many bodies were driven miles away from where they disappeared. While on death row, Bundy admitted that he decapitated over a dozen of his victims and kept their heads for a while. He visited the bodies and applied makeup to the corpses or engaged in sexual acts. He kept souvenirs, photos, women's clothing. To this day, many of his victims remain unknown. It's widely believed that the expert testimony by Dr. Richard Souveron, a forensic dentist, was what secured Bundy's conviction and eventual execution. Bite marks were found on the buttocks of the victim Lisa Levy. The first was a complete bite mark. The second was rotated so that there were 2 impressions of the lower teeth. This gave authorities more places to compare dental records against the mark, which increased the odds of a match. The analysis of the bite marks was possible only because a particularly savvy crime scene investigator who was taking pictures at the scene included a ruler in the photo of the bite mark, in order to show scale. Without this photograph, Bundy might have been acquitted. The bite mark had degraded past identifiable by the time the case was presented in court, so the only useful evidence of its original size and shape was that photograph.
Chapter 6. Rich. "Care to do the honors?" Basil asks me. We are crowded into Jessica Ogilvie's bathroom, me and the pair of CSIs who have been combing the house for evidence. Marcy's taped up the windows with black paper and is standing ready with her camera. Basil has mixed the luminol to spray over the tub, the floors, the walls. I flip the light switch and plunge us into darkness. Basil sprays the solution, and suddenly the bathroom lights up like a Christmas tree, the grout between the tiles glowing a bright fluorescent blue. "Hot damn," Marcy murmurs. "I love it when we're right." Luminol glows when it meets the correct catalyst, in this case, the iron in hemoglobin. Jacob Hunt might have been smart enough to clean up the mess he'd left behind after murdering Jess Ogilvie, but there were still traces of blood that would go far toward convincing a jury of his guilt. "Nice work," I say, as Marcy takes a furious run of photographs. Assuming the blood matches the victim's, this latest piece of the puzzle helps me map out the crime. Jacob Hunt comes for his appointment with the victim. I muse, thinking aloud. They argue, maybe knocking over the CD rack and the mail and a few stools, and he corners her, right here, apparently, beating her up and eventually striking a blow that kills her. As the luminol loses its glow, I flip on the lights. He cleans up the bathroom, and then he cleans up the victim, dressing her and dragging her to the culvert. I glance down at the floor. In full light, you can't see the chemical, and you can't see the blood at all. "But Jacob's a CSI buff," I say. Basil grins. "I read this article in Esquire about how women find us sexier than firemen." "Not all women," Marcy qualifies. "And so," I continue, ignoring them, "he comes back to the scene of the crime and decides to cover his tracks. The thing is, he's smart. He wants to pin this on Mark McGuire. So he thinks to himself, if Mark did this, how would he try to cover it up? As a kidnapping. So he puts on Mark McGuire's boots and stomps around outside, and then cuts the screens in the windows. He cleans up the CDs and the mail and the overturned stools. But he also knows Mark would be sharp enough to want to throw investigators off the trail a little. So he types up the note for the mailman and packs a bag full of the victim's clothes and takes it with him. Both hints that Jess left of her own accord." "You're losing me," Marcy says. "Jacob Hunt doctored his crime scene to look like it had been committed by someone else. Someone who would doctor a crime scene to hide his involvement. It's fucking brilliant," I sigh. "So what are you thinking?" Basil asks. "Lovers quarrel?" I shake my head. "I don't know. Yet." Marcy shrugs. "Too bad perps never seem inclined to talk." "Good thing victims do," I say. Wayne Nussbaum is up to his elbows in the chest cavity of a dead man from Swanton when I snap on a mask and booties and enter the room. "I can't hang around anymore," I say. "For the past 45 minutes, I've been cooling my heels in Wayne's office." "Neither can he," Wayne replies, and I notice the ligature marks around the guy's neck. "Look, it's not like I could have predicted a murder-suicide would throw me off schedule." He lifts a gleaming red organ in his palm, his eyes dancing. "Come on, detective, have a heart." I don't crack a smile. "That the kind of stuff you learn at clown college?" "Yep, it comes after pie-throwing 101. He turns to his deaner, a young woman who assists him during autopsies. Her name is Lila, and she once tried to hit on me by inviting me to a rave in South Burlington. Instead of flattering me, it just made me feel really old. "Lila," he says, "give me 10 minutes. He strips off his gloves and jacket and booties as soon as we're out of the sterile atmosphere and walks beside me down the hall to his office. He shuffles files on his desk until I see one with Jess Ogilvie's name on the tab. "I don't know what else I can tell you that my report didn't already spell out crystal clear," Wayne says, sitting down. "Cause of death was a subdural hematoma due to a basilar skull fracture. He popped her so hard he drove her skull into her brain and killed her." I knew that, but it wasn't really why Jess Ogilvie had died. That was because she'd said something to Jacob Hunt that had set him off. Or maybe she had refused to say something to him, such as, "I feel the same way about you." It would be simple enough to assume that a boy who fell for his tutor and was rebuffed might lash out at her. Wayne skims through his report. "The lacerations on her back, drag marks, were made post-mortem. I'd assume they'd occurred when the body was moved. There were bruises, however, that were made pre-mortem. The facial ones, of course, and a few on her upper arms and throat." "No semen?" Wayne shook his head. "Nada." "Could he have worn a condom?" "Highly unlikely," the medical examiner says. "We didn't get any pubic hairs or any other physical evidence concurrent with rape." "But her underwear was on backward." "Yeah, but that only proves that your perp hasn't shopped for lingerie, not that he's a rapist." "Those bruises," I say. "Can you tell how old they are?" "Within a day or so," Wayne replies. "There's not really a reliable technique to determine the age of a bruise beyond color and immunohistochemical methods. Bottom line is, people heal at different rates. So although I could look at two bruises and say one occurred a week before the other, I can't look at two bruises and say one occurred at 9 a.m. and the other occurred at noon. So conceivably, the choke marks around her throat and the fingerprint bruises on her arms, those could have happened minutes before she died? Or hours?" Wayne tosses the folder to a pile on the side of his desk. "He could have threatened her and then come back to beat her to death." "Or it could have been two different people at two different times." My gaze meets his. "Then Jessica Ogilvie truly did have the shittiest day on record," the coroner says. "I suppose you could charge the boyfriend with assault. It seems like an unnecessary complication, though, if your perp already confessed to moving the body." "Yeah, I know. I just didn't understand why that bothered me so much." "Can I ask you something?" "Sure." "Why did you stop being a clown?" "It wasn't fun anymore. Kids screaming in my face, barfing their birthday cake in my lap." Wayne shrugs. "My clients here are much more predictable." "I guess." The coroner looks at me for a long moment. "You know the hardest case I ever did? Motor vehicle accident. Woman rolls her SUV on the highway, and her baby pops right out of the car seat and suffers severe spinal injuries and dies. They brought the whole car seat into the morgue. I had to put that dead baby back into the seat and show how the mother didn't buckle it the right way, which is why the kid fell out." Wayne stands up. "Sometimes you have to keep reminding yourself that you're in this for the victim." I nod, and wonder why that label makes me think not of Jess Ogilvie, but of Jacob Hunt.
This ends Disc 8. House Rules, Disc 9.
The boy who answers the door at the Hunt household looks nothing like his brother. But the minute I show my badge, the color drains from his face. "I'm Detective Mattson," I say. "Is your mother home?"
I plead the fifth," the kid says.
"That's great," I tell him, but it wasn't a particularly probing question.
Who's at the door? I hear, and then Emma Hunt steps into my line of sight. The minute she recognizes me, her eyes narrow. Did you come to check up on me? Well, I'm here with the boys, just like the judge ordered. Close the door, Theo, and you, she says, can talk to our lawyer. I manage to wedge my foot in the door just before it closes. I have a search warrant. I hold up the piece of paper that will allow me to comb through Jacob's bedroom and take away what might constitute evidence. She takes the paper out of my hand, scans it, and then lets the door swing open again. Without speaking, she turns on her heel. I follow her into the house, pausing when she picks up the phone in the kitchen and calls her baby-faced lawyer. Yes, he's here now, she says, cupping her hand around the receiver. He gave the paper to me. She hangs up a moment later. Apparently, I don't have a choice. I could have told you that, I say cheerfully. But she turns away and walks upstairs. I keep a few steps behind until she opens a door. Jacob, baby? I stand in the hallway and let her talk softly to her son. I hear words like required and legal, and then she reappears with Jacob at her side. It takes me by surprise. The kid's whole face is black and blue. A butterfly bandage disappears into his hairline. Jacob, I say, how are you doing? How does it look like he's doing? Emma snaps. I'd been told by Helen Sharp that Jacob was released into his mother's custody pending the competency hearing. She had said that, apparently, Jacob couldn't handle jail well. We'd laughed about it. Who can handle jail well? My job as a detective is to go behind the scenes and see what strings are controlling the puppets. Sometimes that means collecting evidence, or swearing out arrest warrants, or getting background information or conducting interrogations. But it usually also means I miss what is going on stage. It was one thing to arrest Jacob and send him off to his arraignment. It's another thing entirely to see this boy in front of me again in this condition. He doesn't look like the kid I interviewed a week ago. No wonder his mother wants my head. She takes Jacob's hand to lead him down the hallway. But we are all stopped by the thin, reedy sound of the boy's voice. Wait, Jacob whispers. Emma turns, her face lighting up. Jacob, did you say something? I get the sense that, if he's been saying anything, it's not a lot. He nods, his mouth working for a moment before another syllable is forced out. I want... What do you want, baby? I'll get it for you. I want to watch. Emma faces me, her eyebrows raised in a question. Not possible, I tell her flatly. He can stay in the house, but he can't be anywhere near the room. Can I speak to you for a moment? She asks evenly, and she walks into Jacob's bedroom, leaving him in the hallway. Do you have any idea what kind of hell it is to watch your child become completely unresponsive? No, but... Well, this is the second time for me. I haven't even been able to get him out of his bed, she says. And as I recall, the last thing you said to me was that I should trust you. I did, and you stabbed me in the back and arrested my son after I offered him up to you on a silver platter. From where I'm standing... My son wouldn't be hanging on by a thread if it weren't for you. So if watching you load up your goddamn boxes with his possessions is what brings him back to the world of the living, then I would hope, for the sake of common decency, you'd simply let him. By the time she finishes, her eyes are glittering and her cheeks are flushed. I open my mouth about to talk about search and seizure cases in the Supreme Court, but then change my mind. Jacob? I stick my head out the door. Come on in. He sits down on the bed, and Emma leans against the door jamb with her arms crossed. I'm just going to take a look around, I say, Jacob Hunt is a wicked neat freak. One weekend with Sasha and I'm forever finding tiny socks wedged into the couch, or cereal underfoot in the kitchen, or books left strewn across the living room floor. But something tells me this isn't the case with Jacob. His bed is made with military precision. His closet is so organized it looks like an advertisement. I'd assume he has a full-blown case of OCD, except for the fact that there are exceptions to the rule. His math notebook, lying open, is a disaster. Loose-leaf pages, haphazardly stuffed, papers falling out, handwriting so messy it looks like modern art. The same goes for a bulletin board on one wall, which is overstuffed with papers and pictures and photographs overlapping each other. Dirty dishes and mugs litter his desk. Directly across from the desk is a small table with an overturned fish tank that has been kitted out like a fuming chamber. Jacob sees me looking at it. "What do you get prints off?" I ask.
"Don't answer that, Jacob," Emma interjects. "Toothbrushes," he replies. "Mugs. I once got a great partial off a manila folder with magnetic powder."
His mother and I both stare at him. Emma, because he's probably said more in the last second than in the past 3 days, and I, because there are CSIs who don't even know that technique for getting prints off a porous surface. I pick up the trash bin beside the desk and begin to leaf through it. There are several drafts of an English essay. There's a gum wrapper. What's extraordinary about the contents is not what they are, but how they are. Instead of being balled up or crumpled, each piece of garbage has been folded into crisp eighths, even the tiny gum wrapper. The trash is stacked like laundry. The first item I take is Jacob's police scanner. Now I know how he managed to get to the crime scene for the hypothermic guy. Jacob's hand begins to flap a little harder.
That's mine.
Emma puts her hand on his shoulder.
Remember what I said.
I quickly procure the items that are in the fuming chamber. A mug, a mirror, the tank itself. I look under Jacob's bed, but there's only a pair of slippers and two plastic bins. One filled with back issues of the Journal of Forensic Sciences, the other filled with Legos. From his bookshelf, I take the complete DVD series of Crime Busters, and then I see the composition notebooks. He told me he has more than 100, and he wasn't lying. I pull the first one down.
"You can't have those," Jacob cries.
"I'm sorry, Jacob." Episode 74, I read. Silent Witness, 12-4-08. Two teenagers out for a joyride run over a deaf man, who turns out to be already dead. This is followed by a list of evidence. Solved, it reads, 36 minutes. Emma has her head bent close to Jacob's now. She's murmuring, but I cannot hear the words. Turning my back to them, I flip through the entries. Some are repeats of episodes. Jacob seems to have written about each of them when they aired, even if he'd seen the show before. Some of them have the disclaimer that Jacob could not solve the crime before the TV detectives did. There are kidnappings, stabbings, cult ritual murders. One episode catches my eye. Joffrey puts on her boyfriend's boots and leaves prints in the mud behind the house to mislead investigators. Stuck between the pages is a pink index card, and as I scan it, I realize this is a note Jacob has written to himself. "I am miserable. I can't stand it anymore. The people who supposedly care don't. I get my hopes up, and everyone eventually lets me down. I finally know what's wrong with me. All of you. All of you who think I'm just an autistic kid. So who really cares? Well, I hate you. I hate all of you. I hate how I cry at night because of you. But you are just people. Just people. So why do you make me feel so small?" Was this written a week ago, a month, a year? Was it in response to bullying in school? To a teacher's criticism? to something Jess Ogilvy said? It could point to motive. I quickly close the journal and stick the notebook into the box. You can't see that index card anymore, but I know it's there, and it feels too private, too raw to be considered simply evidence. All of a sudden, I'm flooded by the image of Jacob Hunt huddled in his room after a whole day of trying unsuccessfully to blend in with the hundreds of kids in his school. Who, out of all of us, hasn't felt marginalized at some point? Who hasn't felt like they don't belong? Who hasn't tried and failed? I had been the fat kid, the one who was stuck in the soccer goal during gym class and cast as a rock in the school play. I'd been called doughboy, lardass, earthquake boy, you name it. In eighth grade, after a graduation ceremony, a kid had come up to me. "I never knew your real name was Rich," he'd said. When my dad got laid off and we had to move to Vermont for his new job, I spent the summer reinventing myself. I ran a half mile the first day, and then a whole one, and gradually more. I ate only green things. I did 500 sit-ups every morning before I even brushed my teeth. By the time I got to my new school, I was a totally different guy, and I never looked back. Jacob Hunt can't exercise himself into a new personality. He can't move to another school district and start over. He'll always be the kid with Asperger's. Unless, instead, he makes himself the kid who killed Jess Ogilvy. "I'm all done here," I say, stacking the boxes. "I just need you to sign the receipt for the property so you can eventually get it back."
"And when might that be?"
"When the DA's done with it." I turn to say goodbye to Jacob, but he's staring at the empty spot where his fuming chamber was located. Emma walks me downstairs.
"You're wasting your time," she says. "My son isn't a murderer."
I push the inventory receipt toward her, silent.
"If I were Jess's parents, I'd want to know the police were actively trying to find the person who killed my child instead of basing their entire case on the ridiculous notion that an autistic boy with no criminal history, a boy who loved Jess, killed her."
She signs the receipt I give her and then opens the front door.
"Are you even listening?" she says, her voice rising. "You've got the wrong person."
There have been times, albeit very rarely, that I wished this were the case. When I snapped handcuffs on an abused wife who'd gone after her husband with a knife, for example. Or when I arrested a guy who'd broken into a grocery store to steal formula for his baby because he couldn't afford it. But just like then, I can't contradict the evidence that's in front of me now. I may feel bad for someone who's committed a crime, but that doesn't mean he hasn't committed it. I pick up the boxes and, at the last moment, turn back. "I'm sorry," I say. "For what it's worth, I'm really sorry." Her eyes flash.
"You're sorry? For what exactly? Lying to me? Lying to Jacob? Throwing him into jail without giving any thought to his special needs?"
Technically, the judge did that.
"How dare you," Emma shouts. "How dare you come in here as if you're on our side, and then turn around and do this to my son?"
"There are no sides," I yell back at her. "There's just a girl who died alone and scared, and who was found a week later frozen solid. Well, I've got a girl, too. What if it had been her?" By now, my face is flushed. I'm inches away from Emma.
"I didn't do this to your son," I say more softly. "I did this for my daughter."
The last thing I see is Emma Hunt's jaw drop. She doesn't speak to me as I heft the boxes more firmly in my arms and walk down her driveway. But then, it's never the differences between people that surprise us. It's the things that, against all odds, we have in common.
Jacob. My mother and I are riding in the car to the office of the state psychiatrist, who happens to work out of a hospital. I'm nervous about this because I don't like hospitals. I've been in them twice, once when I fell out of a tree and broke my arm, and once when Theo got hurt after I knocked over his high chair. What I remember about hospitals is that they smell white and stale, the lights are too bright, and every time I've been in one, I've either been in pain or ashamed, or maybe both. This makes my fingers start to flutter on my leg, and I stare at them as if they're disconnected from my body. For the past 3 days, I've been doing better. I'm taking all my supplements again and my shots, and it hasn't felt quite as much as if I'm constantly swimming in a bubble of water that makes it harder to understand what people say or to focus on them. Believe me, I know it's not normal to flap my hands or walk in circles or repeat words over and over, but sometimes it's the easiest way to make myself feel better. It's like a steam engine, really. Fluttering my hands in front of my face or against my leg is my exhaust valve. And maybe it looks weird, but then again, just compare it to the folks who turn to alcohol or porn to alleviate pressures. I haven't been out of the house since I left the jail. Even school is off limits now, so my mother has found textbooks and is homeschooling both Theo and me. It's sort of nice, actually, not having to stress out about the next time I'll be accosted by another student and will have to interact, or if a teacher will say something I don't understand, or if I'll need to use my COP pass and look like a total loser in front of my peers. I wonder why we never thought of this before, learning without socialization. It's every Aspie's dream. Every now and then, my mother looks at me in the rearview mirror. "You remember what's going to happen, right?" she asks. "Dr. Cohn is going to ask you questions. All you have to do is tell the truth." Here's the other reason I'm nervous. The last time I went off to answer questions without my mother, I wound up in jail. "Jacob," my mother says, "you're stimming." I slap my free hand over the one that's fluttering. When we get to the hospital, I walk with my head ducked down so that I don't have to see sick people. I haven't vomited since I was 6 years old. The very thought of it makes me sweat. Once, when Theo got the flu, I had to take my sleeping bag and quilt and stay in the garage because I was afraid I'd catch it. What if coming here for a stupid competency interview turns out to be much worse than anyone anticipates? "I don't understand why he couldn't come to us," I mutter. "Because he's not on our side," my mother says. The way competency works is this. 1. The state of Vermont hires a psychiatrist who will interview me and tell the judge everything the DA wants to hear. 2. My lawyer will counter this with Dr. Moon, my own psychiatrist, who will tell the judge everything Oliver Bond wants to hear. Frankly, I don't see the point, since we all know this is how it's going to shake out anyway. Dr. Martin Cohn's office is not as nice as Dr. Moon's. Dr. Moon decorates in shades of blue, which has been proven to enhance relaxation. Dr. Martin Cohn decorates in industrial gray. His secretary's desk looks like the one my math teacher uses. "Can I help you?" she asks. My mother steps forward. "Jacob Hunt is here to see Dr. Cohn." "You can go right in," she points to another doorway. Dr. Moon has that too. You go into her office through one door and exit through the other, so that no one who's waiting will see you. I know it's supposed to be about privacy, but if you ask me, it's like the psychiatrists themselves are buying into that stupid belief that therapy is something to hide. I put my hand on the doorknob and take a deep breath. "This time, you're coming back," I promise myself. A joke. A guy is flying in a hot air balloon, and he's lost. He lowers himself over a cornfield and calls out to a woman. "Can you tell me where I am and where I'm headed?" "Sure," this woman says. "You're at 41 degrees, 2 minutes, and 14 seconds north, 144 degrees, 4 minutes, 19 seconds east. You're at an altitude of 762 meters above sea level, and right now you're hovering, but you were on a vector of 234 degrees at 12 meters per second. Amazing! Thanks! By the way, do you have Asperger's syndrome? I do, the woman replies. How did you know? Because everything you said is true, it's much more detail than I need, and you told me in a way that's of no use to me at all. The woman frowns. Huh, are you a psychiatrist? I am, the man says. But how the heck could you tell? You don't know where you are. You don't know where you're headed. You got where you are by blowing hot air. You put labels on people after asking a few questions. And you're in exactly the same spot you were in 5 minutes ago. But now, somehow, it's my fault. Dr. Martin Cohn is smaller than I am and has a beard. He wears glasses without rims, and as soon as I come into the room, he walks toward me. Hello, he says. I'm Dr. Cohn. Take a seat. The chairs are metal frames with pleather cushions. One is orange, and that's totally not happening. The other is gray and has a sunken circle in the middle, as if the cushion has simply given out. When I was younger and I was asked to take a seat, I'd lift it up. Now I know that it means I am supposed to sit down. There are many statements that do not mean what they say. Mark my words. Hang around. Just a second. Get off my back. The psychiatrist takes out a pen from his pocket. He sits down, too, and puts his yellow pad on his lap. What's your name? Jacob Thomas Hunt, I say. How old are you, Jacob? 18. Do you know why you're here? Don't you? He writes something down on his paper. Do you know that you've been charged with a crime? Yes, 13 VSA, section 2301, murder committed by means of poison or by lying in wait, or by willful, deliberate, and premeditated killing, or committed in perpetrating or attempting to perpetrate arson, sexual assault, aggravated sexual assault, robbery, or burglary, shall be murder in the first degree. All other kinds of murder shall be murder in the second degree. I would have thought reciting the entire statute would impress Dr. Cohn, but he doesn't register any emotion. Maybe he's got Asperger's too. Do you understand whether that's a major or minor charge, Jacob? It's a felony that carries a minimum sentence of 35 years to life in prison. Dr. Cohn looks up over his glasses. What about probation? He asks. Do you know what that is? It's when you have to check in with a court officer for a certain amount of time, I say. You have to follow rules and give reports. You have to have a job. You have to live somewhere where they know your address. You have to stay out of trouble. You have to not drink alcohol. Right, Dr. Cohn says. Tell me, Jacob, what should your lawyer focus on in order to defend you? I shrug. My innocence. Do you understand what a plea of guilty or not guilty means? Yes. Guilty means that you admit you committed the crime and that you need to be punished for it. Not guilty means you don't admit you committed the crime and you don't think you should be punished for it. But it's not the same as being innocent, because in our legal system, you get found guilty or not guilty. You don't get found innocent, even if you are, like me. Dr. Cohn stares at me. What's a plea bargain? When the prosecutor talks to the lawyer and they agree on a sentence, and then they both go before the judge to see if the judge will accept that too. It means you don't have to have a trial because you've admitted to the crime by taking the plea. These are all easy questions, because at the end of every Crime Busters episode is a trial, where the evidence is relayed to a judge and jury. If I'd known the questions were going to be this simple, I wouldn't have been so nervous. Instead, I'd been expecting Dr. Cohn to ask me about Jess, about what happened that afternoon. And of course, I couldn't tell him, which would mean I'd have to lie, and that would be breaking the rules. What's an insanity plea? Dr. Cohn asks. When you claim you're not guilty because you were dissociated from reality at the time you committed the crime and can't be held legally responsible for your actions, like Edward Norton in Primal Fear. Great flick, the psychiatrist says. Jacob, if your lawyer thinks you shouldn't testify, would you agree to that? Why wouldn't I want to testify? I'm going to tell the truth. When can you speak out in the courtroom? I can't. My lawyer told me not to talk to anyone. What do you think your chances are of being found not guilty? 100%, I say, since I didn't do it. Do you know how strong the case is against you? Obviously not, since I haven't seen the discovery. You know what discovery is? Dr. Cohn asks, surprised. I roll my eyes. Pursuant to Rule 16 of the Vermont Rules of Discovery, Rules of Procedure for the Superior Court, the prosecution is required to turn over all the evidence they have in the case, including the photographs, documents, statements, physical examinations, and any other material that they intend to use at the trial. And if they don't turn it over, then I'm allowed to go free. Do you understand the difference between the defense, the prosecution, the judge, the jury, the witnesses? I nod. The defense is my team, my lawyer and the witnesses and me, because we're defending me against the crime the prosecution's charged me with. The judge is the man or woman who has authority over everyone in the courtroom. He runs the trial and listens to the evidence and makes decisions about the law. And the judge I met a few days ago wasn't very nice and sent me to jail. I take a breath. The jury is a group of 12 that listens to the facts and hears the evidence and the arguments of the lawyers and then goes into a room where no one can hear them or see them, and they decide the outcome of the case. As an afterthought, I add, the jury is supposed to be 12 peers, but technically that would mean every single person on the jury should have Asperger's syndrome, because then they'd really understand me. Dr. Cohn makes another note. Do you have confidence in your lawyer, Jacob? No, I say. The first time I met him, I wound up in jail for 3 days. Do you agree with how he's handling the case? Obviously not. He needs to tell them the truth so that the charges will be dismissed. That's not how it works, Dr. Cohn says. It worked that way in My Cousin Vinny, I tell him. When Joe Pesci tells the court that the car isn't the same as the one the witness identified because it had different tires. And it worked that way on Crime Busters, episode 88. Do you want me to tell you about it? No, that's okay, Dr. Cohn says. Jacob, what would you do if a witness told a lie on the stand? I feel my fingers start to flutter. So I clamp my other hand down on top of them. How would I know? I say. Only the liar knows that he's lying.
Oliver. On paper, Jacob Hunt not only looks competent to stand trial, but looks like a damn pre-law student, one who is probably more qualified to defend himself than I am. Only the liar knows that he's lying. It's the third time I've read Jacob's answers to Dr. Cohn, the state shrink, and the third time that statement has jumped out at me. Is Jacob Hunt brilliant, with a photographic memory that I could have used back in law school? Or is he just snowing his mother and everyone else? Either way, during my last pass through the report, I realized that I didn't have a snowball's chance in hell of challenging his competency, especially in a place like Vermont. No, if anyone's feeling incompetent right now, it's me, because I have to tell Emma that I'm not even going to fight the state on this one. I drive to the Hunts. Since Emma and Jacob are basically under house arrest, I can't very well ask them to meet me in my office. Thor's riding in my lap, half tucked beneath the steering wheel. I pull into the driveway and cut the ignition, but don't make a move to get out of the car. If she goes haywire, I tell the dog, I'm counting on you to defend me. Because it's cold today, just above 0 degrees, I carry Thor inside my coat and head to the front door. Emma answers before I can even knock.
Hi, she says. It's good to see you.
She even smiles a little, which makes her soft around all the edges.
Frankly, when you're stuck in the house, even a visit from the electric company meter reader is a highlight of the day.
And here I thought you were starting to like me. Thor pops his head between the buttons of my coat. Would it be okay to bring him in? It's really cold in the car. She eyes the dog warily. Is he going to pee on my carpet? Only if you keep looking at him like that. I set Thor on the floor of the mudroom and watch him trot away.
I don't like dog hair, Emma murmurs.
Then aren't you lucky you weren't born a spaniel? I take off my coat and fold it over my arm. I got the competency results back.
And?
In one heartbeat, Emma is focused, intense. Jacob's competent to stand trial. She shakes her head, as if she hasn't quite heard me right.
You saw what happened during the arraignment.
Yes, but that's not the legal definition of competency. And according to the state psychiatrist...
I don't care about the state psychiatrist. Of course they're going to find someone who says that what the DA wants. Aren't you at least going to fight back?
You don't understand, I tell her. In Vermont, you could be Charlie Manson and you'd still be found competent to stand trial. I sit down on one of the benches in the mudroom. You ever hear of a guy named John Bean?
No.
In 1993, he tied his mother up and built a funeral pyre for her with furniture he'd chopped into pieces. He threw bleach in her eyes, but his mother was able to escape. At his first appearance before a court, Bean told the judge he was the reincarnation of Jesus Christ. The judge said that his statements were bizarre and indicated an inability to comprehend what was happening. When he was charged with kidnapping for the same event, he refused counsel. He wanted to plead guilty, but the court wouldn't accept that, so he was given a public defender. Bean told an evaluator that he believed he was the father of the public defender's children, and that she was the author of a comic strip and was a cross between Janet Reno and Janet Jackson. Through the next 8 years of representation, he never discussed his case with his attorney, who raised the competency issue with the court.
I don't see what this
I'm not done, I say. The defense shrink said Bean reported having computer chips inside him that were letting him be programmed. The state psychiatrist found him psychotic. During the trial, Bean tore the radiator out of the wall, threw the court television, and got hold of one of the officer's guns. He told his attorney that he was seeing serpents coming out of people's heads in the courtroom, and that angels were controlling the witness. He was convicted, and before sentencing, he told the court that in Riverside Park, they put a memorial stone in the name of the Freddie Mercury Foundation, after Freddie Mercury had killed a Catholic priest. After that, he said Tony Curtis said he would be Bean's father, and he used the greater power of Simon the Pig, the same power that had created the Nazi government, to bring him into his house and feed him human flesh. Oh, and a cat talked to him subliminally. Emma stares at me.
None of this has anything to do with Jacob.
It does, I say, because in the state of Vermont, in spite of everything I just told you, John Bean was found competent to stand trial. That's legal precedent. Emma sinks down onto the bench beside me.
Oh, she says, her voice small. So, what do we do now?
I think we need to plead insanity. Her head snaps up.
What? What are you talking about? Jacob's not insane. You just told me he wasn't competent to stand trial, and now you're telling me he's too competent to use an insanity defense. You can't have it both ways, I argue.
We can look at the discovery when it comes in, but from what you've told me, there's a pretty strong case against Jacob, including a confession. I really believe it's the best way to keep him out of jail. Emma paces the mudroom. A shaft of sunlight falls across her hair and her cheek, and suddenly, I remember an art history course I took in college. In Michelangelo's Pietà, Raphael's Madonna and Child, Da Vinci's Madonna of the Rocks, Mary was never seen smiling. Was it because she knew what was coming down the pike? If the insanity defense works, Emma asks, does he get to come home?
It depends. The judge has the right to put him in a secure treatment facility until he's sure Jacob won't hurt anyone again.
What do you mean, secure treatment facility? You're talking about a mental hospital?
Pretty much, I admit.
So my son can either go to jail or be put in a mental hospital? What about the third option?
What third option?
He's free to go, Emma says. He's acquitted.
I open my mouth to tell her that's a huge gamble, to say that she'd have a better chance of teaching Thor to knit, but instead, I take a deep breath.
Why don't we go ask Jacob?
No way, Emma replies. Unfortunately, that's not your choice. I stand up and walk into the kitchen. Jacob is picking through a bowl of blueberries and giving the smaller ones to Thor.
Did you know he likes fruit?
Jacob asks.
He'll eat anything that's not nailed down, I say.
We have to talk about your case, dude.
Dude?
Emma's come into the room and is standing behind me, arms folded. I ignore her and approach Jacob.
You passed the competency test.
I did, he says, beaming.
Did I do really well?
Emma steps forward.
You did great, baby.
We need to start thinking about your defense, I say. Jacob puts down the bowl of blueberries.
I have some cool ideas. There was this time on Crime Busters when...
This isn't a TV show, Jacob, I say. This is really important. This is your life. He sits down at the kitchen table and lifts Thor onto his lap.
Did you know that the guy who invented Velcro got the idea from taking his dog for a walk in the Alps? When the burrs caught on its fur, he thought about how something with hooks could catch onto anything with a loop.
I sit down across from him.
Do you know what an affirmative defense is?
He nods and spits back the legal definition.
It's a reason for finding the defendant not guilty, such as self-defense, defense of another person, or not guilty by reason of insanity. The defendant has to raise it a certain amount of time before a trial, usually in writing.
What I've been thinking, Jacob, is that your best odds at this trial involve an affirmative defense.
His face lights up. Right, of course. Defense of another person.
Who were you defending? I interrupt. Jacob looks down at Thor and plays with the tags on his collar.
Surely you can't be serious, he says. I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Do you really think you're in a position to be making jokes right now?
It's from Airplane, Jacob says.
Well, it's not funny. The state has a really good case against you, Jacob, which is why I think we need to use an insanity defense.
Jacob's head snaps up. I'm not crazy.
That's not what it means.
I know what it means, he says. It means that a person isn't responsible for criminal conduct if, as a result of mental disease or defect, he lacked the capacity to understand right from wrong at the moment the act was committed. He stands up, knocking Thor to the floor. I don't have a mental disease or defect. I have a quirk, right, Mom?
I glance at Emma. You have got to be kidding me. She hikes her chin up a notch. We've always said that Asperger's isn't a disability, just a different ability.
Great, I say. Well, Jacob, either I run the insanity defense, or you can take that quirk of yours right back to prison.
No, actually, in the state of Vermont, you can't run an insanity defense if I tell you that you can't, Jacob answers. It's all in the Vermont Supreme Court case of State versus Bean, 171, Vermont Reports 290, 762, Atlantic Reporter, 2nd, 1259, 2000.
Jesus Christ, you know that case?
Don't you? He raises his brows.
Why can't you just tell them the truth?
Fine, Jacob. What's the truth? No sooner have I asked than I realize my mistake. Any lawyer knows to be careful what you ask when representing a criminal defendant, since anything he says might incriminate himself. If he gets on the stand later and denies what he told you earlier, you're left in a quandary and have to either withdraw from representation, which would prejudice him,
or tell the court that he's not being truthful, which would prejudice him even more. Instead of asking what happened, you dance around the truth and the facts. You ask the client how he'd answer certain questions. Or, in other words, I just royally screwed up. Now that I've asked him for the truth, I can't let him get up on the stand and incriminate himself. So I stop him from answering. Wait, I don't want to hear it, I say. What do you mean you don't want to hear it? You're supposed to be my lawyer. The reason we can't tell the court the truth is that facts speak a lot louder in a courtroom. You can't handle the truth, Jacob yells. I'm not guilty, and I'm definitely not insane. I scoop up Thor and stalk into the mudroom, Emma following. He's right, she says. Why do you have to plead insanity? If Jacob's not guilty, shouldn't the judge get to hear that? I spin around so quickly she falls back. I want you to think about something. Say you're on the jury for this case, and you've just listened to a long list of facts that tie Jacob to the murder of Jess Ogilvy. Then you get to watch Jacob on the stand explaining his version of the truth. Which story would you believe? She swallows, silent, because this point, at least, she cannot argue. Emma knows very well what Jacob looks like and sounds like to other people, even when Jacob doesn't know it himself. Look, I tell her, Jacob has to accept that this insanity defense is the best chance we've got. How are you going to convince him? I'm not, I say. You are.